Hello and welcome to The Headquarters, the official podcast of RaptorsHQ.com, SB Nation's Toronto Raptors community. I'm your host, Sean Woodley, and I'm joined today to talk about your second round bound Toronto Raptors by Russell Peddle. How are you doing, man?
Woo, motherfucker.
Yes, this is your new new staple line. Listen to the HQ Overtime show from last night to figure out where that came from. And also joined by John Godis. How are you, man?
Good. I actually hosted that show.
Yes, you did.
Masterfully, I might add.
Oh,
yeah, you've become better at this than me. Little behind the curtain, we had about 15 minutes of a podcast recorded full of Space Jam talk and other fun stuff and some really, really hard-hitting Raptors analysis. And I realized it wasn't recording because I suck at this and I'm terrible at everything. So we're going to hammer through this first segment quicker than we did last time. Those Space Jam comments and potential plot lines will be lost to the ether. So sorry about that. Unless you guys want to talk about Space Jam.
We can talk about it briefly, I suppose.
All right. So
you don't have to go off on the Wire tangent, but we can.
Well, now people are just confused, but yeah, I went off on a Wire tangent. I want a grittier, more, you know, real Space Jam, something involving the East Side, West Side basketball game and LeBron and Daffy Duck and drugs and something like that. I think that's just a better way to put it than my detailed description the last time we did this. So. Leave it there. Russell, thoughts on Space Jam? I'm of the mind that it's actually like a pretty bad movie overall. You disagree, though.
I do, simply because it hit me at exactly the right time. I was coming out of the kid stuff and getting into basketball like much bigger, in a much bigger way. And really what helped me get into basketball, funny enough, as a kid were things like NBA Jam and Space Jam and stuff like that. So things with Jam in the title were big for me. So the it's something now where I'm like excited to show it to my kids eventually, and I'm excited that like my wife teaches elementary school and she shows it to her students, and then they love it and stuff like that. Like I think, yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, I guess it's not a great movie, but there aren't many kids movies that really are like Wire to Wire great. So. It touched on the right stuff to make me still appreciate it at this point in my life.
My question to you, or to your wife, I guess, is what educational value is Space Jam providing children?
We're English teachers, so it's in English, so there's that. I mean, English is the second language teachers in Quebec. Both of us are. So,
Bert Sean Woodley.
Basically, any movie would do.
That works. That's a pretty good reasoning. John, are you a Space Jam stan as well?
Yeah, and I didn't get to say all that much because I was still thinking about it when we, you know, hit record and lost everything. But I think Space Jam was perfect because it married the reality of real life with the cartoon world. Like, Michael Jordan was actually playing baseball while that movie was being recorded, and he was actually making his comeback to the real world. They built, like, the Jordan Dome for him, which is excellent. I think, you know, it was Alex, who writes for our site occasionally, had that oral history of that was incredible, the Jordan Dome and what happened that over that summer. So yeah, it was perfect because you got to see Jordan actually contemplate coming back to basketball in the movie where he plays with cartoons, and then in real life he actually did come back. And I don't know if Bill Murray was actually in the audience when he actually came back, but I always thought so as a kid. I always thought that Bill Murray was up there, you know, with the "Let's Go Bulls" classic ending.
See, I don't even like. I've seen Space Jam a million times. I don't really remember anything from it.
Bill Murray was awesome.
Yeah, I guess
he was. He was a movie saver, really, because Michael Jordan was a. You know, I watch it now, and he was not as good of an actor as I remember when I was like 8 or 9 years old. But Bill Murray just saves the whole thing for the adults.
Yeah, I've seen people like kind of crapping on the idea of a Space Jam 2. LeBron actually has some acting chops. Like,
yeah,
he does, man. He's good on. No, he's good on. He's been good on SNL and stuff like that. Give him credit. Like, it's not.
He was good on Trainwreck. Trainwreck.
Yeah, yeah, for sure he was.
It's Cheap LeBron is one of my favorite, random like side movie characters of the last couple years.
I'll give you Trainwreck, but I think that was totally different because it's like a one-faceted character, and he really only had to play that one side. I don't know if he could like
realize how difficult acting
convincing. That's really hard to do, especially in a movie like a Space Jam where you're the only real thing on the whole set.
He's a basketball player. You can't hold him up to that standard. Like if he can,
I'm holding it. He's LeBron James. 2-4 in the finals and 0-3 in movies.
He'll be fine. He'll be fine. But you know who I was saying earlier on the podcast that doesn't exist anymore. Kevin Durant is actually a really funny actor, and I think I'd love to see him. And I don't know, like I missed the news today, like that it's happening. But I mean, have they announced any of the cast yet? Or
no, I don't think so. People were just sort of pondering who should be there. I think Durant and Westbrook would make perfect. Like they've taken over more on Mountain. From the fat guy, who I don't remember his name, and
you don't need to.
Yeah.
Now they're running it, and they're not. And Charlie Villanueva's involved somehow.
He's an idiot.
Good. It would be good for him if he got a job, you know.
Yeah, he might be looking for work. All right, guys, we have so much to get to today. We have got to break down Game 7, where the Raptors narrowly beat the Indiana Pacers, even though they had it, you know, sort of in the bag until the very end. We're going to sort of talk about our first round MVP for the Raptors. We're going to talk about some positive and negative things we can derive from the series. All that good stuff. We're also going to talk about round two because the Miami Heat are coming. Game one is, you're probably listening to this on Tuesday, so it is tonight. This series should be a lot of fun. I have some thoughts. I'm sure you guys have some thoughts about it, whether or not the Raptors stand a chance against the Heat. We will get to that. We will get to our episode sponsor, as always. And please put up with me. I'm sick, and I'm drinking lemon water right now, trying to get through the podcast. So we'll see. At the very least, you get my deep baritone voice. And it's probably better than my regular one. All right, we are going to be back in just a second here on the headquarters. Okay, welcome back to the headquarters. Sean Woodley here with Russell Peddle and John Godis breaking down the Game 7 victory for your Toronto Raptors. They won 89-84. They made it a lot closer than it needed to be. There were some pretty hairy moments down the end. We'll get into what happened at the end of the game to make the game so close. But first, Russell, let's talk about what happened that went well in the first three quarters. Because the Raptors, you know, it was probably the best three-quarter stretch they've strung together in this series. Maybe, you know, game three, a part of game two, would qualify there too as well. But I thought they played, you know, a really nice game for the first 36 minutes. And let's get into that. What was it about what the Raptors were doing early on that you really enjoyed from them? Ah, losing my breath here. What did you like in the first three quarters?
Ball movement. I know that there were a lot of times that it stuck with that it stuck on DeRozan, but like the Raptors had 21 assists. They averaged 16 on the season. They were this, you know, second last in the out of the playoff teams for that. But the thing was is just people were getting open looks. Like they weren't there. Didn't seem to be, like, again, DeRozan's stuff notwithstanding, there didn't seem to be a lot of settling. They were making the extra pass, looking for a better shot. You know, moving, or like I felt like there was less. It wasn't as ISO heavy, and there was more screen setting. They're like, you know, primary and secondary, and I just think that if you took the what really stood out to me is that like those were three quarters of Raptors basketball that was like perfectly, not perfectly, but like as good as you could hope for, realized in the sense that, you know, the rotation was shortened to the player, like Scola. We didn't have to deal with Scola's 8 minutes of frustration because he's making things worse on defense, and like no one can figure out the point of why he's out there. And then, you know, a little less Ross out there making mental mistakes, and just everything was tight and it felt good. It felt like, okay, this is the Raptors team we want in the playoffs. These are the lineups. Some of the lineups were decisions always having a starter on the floor, things like that. Like those are the things you want to see your team do in the playoffs. You don't want to see these all bench lineups. You don't want to give time for the team to give up its lead. So I was just imagining like taking those three quarters and then the fourth quarter of game five and like sticking them together. And like, that's the tape of what I want the Raptors to be.
Mm-hmm. John, anything else to add there?
Yeah, not a whole lot. I think Russell hit all the good points there. Tightening the rotation is something, obviously, that's huge for the Raptors in a Game 7 situation. And the stars showed up for the most part. Lowry's shot is obviously still cratering a little bit here. But DeMar DeRozan had kind of his moment as a Toronto Raptors leader, as an all-star. I know we'll get into him a little bit more here in a second, so I won't go on too long about him. But I thought the first three quarters showed that the team can play playoff basketball, which is less guys, you know, for longer minutes. They understood their roles. They played their roles really well, especially guys like Norman Powell and Damari Carroll. You know, Patrick Patterson made shots when they were open. And it just seemed like everybody was doing what they're supposed to do, which is what you want to see from a two seed in a Game 7. So, yeah, very promising. It's too bad that they played a little bit of prevent down the stretch to give it back, but they're not perfect, those Toronto Raptors. So I'll give that.
We'll get to that fourth quarter performance in just a second. A couple of things I wanted to touch on. I thought the Raptors did a really nice job of limiting Indiana getting out on the run. Only 8 turnovers in this game for the Raptors, which if there was one sort of underlying theme throughout the entire series, was that if the Raptors were giving up a ton of turnovers, the Pacers were killing them, because their dudes were just, you know, open for transition threes and layups, and it was just ugly. Miles Turner had a really bad game. That was a good development. He was 2 of 11. He only played 28 minutes in this game, which I think he's been playing more than that throughout most of the series. One thing that was really concerning to me early in the game was Monta Ellis playing like vintage Kyle Lowry. he was like carving into the Raptors defense. Like really, the first quarter was, you know, the Pacers playing the Raptors offense, really, with Monta Ellis sort of initiating everything and just finding guys for open threes. That was a little concerning early on, but the Raptors sort of tidied up the rotations a little bit. And I mean, you know, Indiana still shot 46% in this game, 9 of 19 from 3, but, you know, it was those turnovers and the limiting the extra possessions that Indiana was getting that was really huge. Let's get to DeMar DeRozan. 10 of 32, 30 points, 5 rebounds, 2 assists, 3 steals, 2 blocks. One of those blocks was massive in the fourth quarter. Let's go to you, Russell. This is, I guess, a very mixed bag with DeRozan again for this game. It really did seem like he was, you know, there was a stretch in the third quarter where they really built the lead based on, you know, the play of DeRozan. He was awesome for a good stretch there. But then he had, you know, at the same time, a bunch of forced looks against guys like, you know, George Hill, that you figure he could have backed down for deeper position in the post, but instead he just settled for these fallaway jumpers. What did you make of DeRozan's game? Are you happy with it? Are you hoping for, are you hoping we never see something like that again from him? What did you make of it?
I mean, you got the ultimate DeRozan experience, right? Like, he shot 30, he scored 30 points on 32 shots. But at the end of the day, he gave a crap. And what, like, you could ask him to make better decisions with certain shots, but at the end of the day, his hands were all over this game. Like you read the stat line and it was just absolutely full. And we don't necessarily always see that from him. I mean, to have 3 steals, 2 blocks, only 1 turnover, 5 rebounds. Like, yes, the shooting makes the line look poor, but everything else makes it look great. And if you were watching the game, obviously you saw that he got timely buckets. And at the end of the day, he really gave it everything. I found, like, he put it all out there. Like, this is the player that DeMar is, and he gave everything he could give for that one game, for that opportunity to win. And for his, because you got to keep in mind, like, for all the futility that the Raptors have had playoff wise for the last 15 years, DeRozan's been there for almost half of it, and this was his opportunity, whether he stays or whether he goes this summer, to really have a better lasting impression. And in his mind, it was clear that he had to do what he was doing for his team to win. And like I said last night on the Overtime podcast, and like I said earlier on the podcast that we didn't record, if the team had lost, we would be blaming it on him. But the team wouldn't have won without him either. You know what I mean? So it was the timeliness of the baskets. It was just the unbelievable will to keep shooting when you're when it's not going well. And I know that that's something that frustrates people and fans, and there are times that it frustrates me as well, but you have to understand that, you know, at the end of the day, this series, he was guarded by one of the best wing perimeter defenders in the league, and someone who just he did not match up well with, but he is, whether we like it or not, he is one of the best players on this team. He is an all-star for a reason. We can't forget that his regular season, whether it was, you know, 70-some-odd games, we all kind of turned around on him and realized that, like, you know, he was driving more. He was getting to the free throw line. There's a lot of value in what he brings to the team. He draws double teams. He can swing the ball. There are things that he brings other than, yes, he misses shots and he takes these fadeaways, wastes these possessions almost. But at the end of the day, like, you know, the adage of live with DeRozan or die with DeRozan, we had the chance to do both. And at the end of the day, the team is still alive. So, he was undeniably a big part of that.
John, anything to add there?
Yeah, I think when I watched that Game 7 back, there's just DeRozan versus the alternatives, right? It's a Game 7. The team is what it is at this point in time, right? Kyle Lowry can't shoot the ball, so you can't really expect him to create at the point of attack and have defenses honor his shot that well. He did his part, I think, but it wasn't as impressive as a performance as you would expect from Lowry and that we've kind of come accustomed to over the last couple months as his shot has become kind of cratered here. So, I mean, what are you going to do? Are you going to throw the ball to Valanciunas, who was struggling late in the series? His hands just were not that good and pretty much from game four.
They were playing them really tough, too.
Yeah, and Mahimi had played an excellent series after getting beat up the first couple games. And then the alternatives are the role players. And Terrence Ross, you know, he wasn't playing well. You're not going to give the ball to Norman Powell to create for your offense. It was really just up to DeRozan to win or lose the game for the team. And if he was going to shoot them out of it, he was going to shoot them out of it. And if he was going to make timely buckets, he was going to do that. And I think he did a bit of both in classic DeRozan fashion, like Russell said off the top. And they won the game. That's really all that matters. They won the game. It was always going to be DeRozan's game to win or lose just based on where Kyle Lowry is at. And I think that they pulled it out. That's all you can say.
For sure. And we'll get more into DeRozan in the next segment where we look ahead to the Miami series. Let's get to that fourth quarter, though, because the Raptors scored 11 points. They were up 14 going into the quarter. It was very, very reminiscent of that. That run at the end of the game five. I'm losing my mind here. You know, Indiana's offense wasn't great, but the Raptors just kept leaving the door wide open. Pretty much exactly what happened in that that fourth quarter in game five. It really, like, the thing that stood out to me, it's like they played offense like the Denver Broncos played offense in the final few minutes against the Patriots this year in the playoffs, where it was just like, yeah, we're not really going to try to do anything. We're just going to come down, kill some clock, give it back to you guys and see if we can get a stop. And, you know, it worked for a little bit, and then, you know, the Pacers started hitting shots. And, you know, it took a offensive foul call on Paul George on what could have been a three-point play. And, you know, a couple of, you know, timely rebounds for the Raptors to pull it out. I guess, Russell, what... is there anything that really stood out to you as being like a glaring problem in that fourth quarter?
I talked about this last night as well. It was clock management at the end. Like, obviously they had a 16-point lead. They wanted to take time off the clock to increase their chances of winning, because with every minute that passed, of course, with that big of a lead, even if it gets reduced, just you're playing the odds. You have a better chance of winning the game. But I mean, at the end of the day, killing clock at this point for two seed with a coach of the year candidate shouldn't be wasting possessions to the point where you're running down clock for the sake of running it down and not getting into a set until there's like 12 or 11 seconds left on the clock. Like, you can just run longer sets or, you know, look for other options until you get there are other ways to run the clock, and it just looked really... it was amateur hour the way they were running the clock out. And that was the frustrating thing, because really all they had to do was they still needed to have a few successful possessions, but like the one thing that couldn't happen was that they get like nothing out of every possession, and that's basically what was happening.
Mm-hmm. John, anything to add there?
Yeah, I think it is really just that simple, that they tried to run the clock out and they failed to run their offense effectively. In game six, the Pacers really shut down that single pick and roll set that the Raptors like to run late in games. They hedged really hard, and in game seven, they were hedging well outside the three-point line to the point where Lowry or Joseph were starting the offense 35 feet from the basket. And the Raptors never adjusted, and the fact they never adjusted just goes to tell you that they expected to win the game by just running the clock out in their, you know, less aggressive offensive sets. And it almost came back to bite them. It was infuriating to watch at the time, but understandable when you consider how the team, you know, had, you know, one effective player to create for them. It was just they weren't putting their guys in a position to be successful by running the same set over and over again. And it did, like Russell said, it looked like amateur hour. I'm glad that it all turned out well in the end. Otherwise, we'd be talking a lot more about this fourth in a much sadder fashion, I think.
Well, I mean, I think if the quarter was an extra 2 minutes long, then I think the Raptors probably lose that game.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
And it's a very, very different tone today. It's weird. I think that's been the problem a lot of the time this season, where they've had these fourth quarters where they just sort of lapse. It's, you know, they get comfortable and they just try to grind it down. And I'm not sure whether that's a coaching thing, whether it's just a human nature thing. I don't know. But that's something I really hope that we don't see again. I hope they learn their lesson from almost blowing game seven and the season and sending the team into an off season of complete upheaval by doing that the fourth quarter. So hopefully they learned.
Yeah. Well, one thing I wanted to add there, you wrote a good article about Jonas Valanciunas' screens. I thought down the stretch that they would be better put into position for success if they had played Biombo and Patterson, because to initiate that offense in that basic set, they need a good screen at the point of attack at that 18 to 16 seconds on the shot clock. And Valanciunas was just setting awful screens in the fourth quarter. They were hedging off of it. He wasn't rolling that hard. And he just needs to be better at that. And it's going to be huge in the Heat series, as I'm sure we'll get to. But I thought you were good to point that out in a good article, because it showed in game six, and then it showed down the stretch in game seven as well.
Oh, thanks, man. Yeah, it was even times, too, where he was rolling but only taking like a couple steps and then just kind of stopping in the middle and clogging everything for, you know, whether it was Lowry or Joseph or DeRozan. Like, yeah, it was brutal. I was surprised they kept Valanciunas in for as long as they did, given how quick Casey's been to go offense-defense this season and willing to put Biombo in crunch time. So that was interesting. Let's just sort of look at a couple things from the series. First off, I want to get a positive and a negative from each of you from what the Raptors did in this series. It can be a small, minute thing. It can be something bigger picture. But let's do that. Russell, give me a positive that you can derive from this series.
A positive that I can derive from this series. I would say that the emergence of Norm Powell as a shutdown wing defender.
Yeah.
When you look at just look at the series ahead of us. It's another matchup with Joe Johnson. It's 2 years removed, but one of the big problems with the series 2 years ago was that Joe Johnson was just destroying DeRozan in the post, and you bring in Damari Carroll for a guy like that, and but now on top of it, you have Norman Powell. So you have basically two options as wing defenders. And, you know, on a team like going in just the series that we're going into, for instance, like I said, you're going up against Dwayne Wade and Joe Johnson. And I think that that's a positive going forward, is that Norm Powell specifically has emerged from being a garbage time player at the beginning of the season, someone who didn't really have much of 3-point range, and now can come in to defend someone, but then also spread the floor and hit open jumpers. And yeah, I'd say his emergence is the big, like, obviously this was happening late in the season, but game seven was really his coming out party. Like, the casual fans that I've spoken to among my friends in the last couple days since last night. So today, all the talk is about Norman Powell. It's just like, man, this kid is so good. He's so good. He really, watching him play defense was a work of art, and you know, all this stuff. And it's crazy the impact he had on the game for a guy that scored 13 points, right? So yeah, that's my positive for sure.
John, what about you?
Oh, I took my Norm Powell thunder. Sorry. That's okay. I think the other positive is just that they did it, right? That they won the game 7 when it was put on their home court. The fans were tremendous. They were a huge positive, I think, in this series. Just from the Pacers' comments after the game, Paul George said something like, the crowd just pushed them through those three quarters to a degree that we hadn't seen before. I think, you know, you were there. It was just like incredibly loud. That came through the TV. And that's...
Well, my ears were ringing this morning when I woke up.
Yeah, that's just incredible. And it must be just incredible to play for all those fans. And I think there's no doubt that that was one of the huge positives for the Raptors in this series. Because if that Game 7 is in Indiana after the Game 6 letdown, regardless of the home court in that game, I think that it's a totally different game and a totally different outcome. So it's good. It's good that they got that sense of relief, that elation after the game. That would just be a huge positive for me. And then the coming out of Norman Powell. And just to add to the Norman Powell conversation, I think that just as important as having him be a shutdown wing defender is that he's a change of pace guy from Damari Carroll. Like, Carroll has a different style of defense, I think. He's a much better positional defender, and he's got great footwork, and he's able to kind of contest shots in a kind of Shane Battier fashion where he pulls right up into the face of the guy and takes away his airspace. But Norm Powell is aggressive right from the touch, and it gave Paul George two different looks. You know, George got off to a good start in the game, but fell off a little bit and then got back into it. And having two guys like that to give different looks kind of positions the Raptors better than any other team left in the East to guard good wing players with two different looks. So I think that's huge for Powell as well.
Yeah, Paul George kind of touched on that last night in his postgame where he said, you know, one of the toughest things about the series was, you know, being guarded by, I think he said, 5 different guys. He's like, yeah, like, that's tough. You got to you sort of adjust your strategy for all these different guys you're facing.
Yeah.
Norm Powell's awesome.
And keep in mind the other thing, that when Atlanta got just destroyed in the Eastern Conference Final last year, and Damari Carroll was, you know, awful against LeBron James, let's just say it, until he got injured, it was because they never had that change of pace guy, and LeBron is able to get comfortable and he's able to play his game. I think that having that second guy is huge for a team that wants to go really far, and we're going to talk about the Heat later, but it's really big having him against a guy like Dwayne Wade.
For sure. My positive from the series, I thought Dwayne Casey did a hell of a job in the series. You know, it took him forever to make the starting lineup change, but eventually he did it. And, you know, while, you know, it didn't start off, so the game 6 was pretty ugly. And, you know, I think, what was the first game they did that in, actually? Was it game 5?
5.
Yeah, it was game 5. Okay, so game 5, it didn't go so well. But all told, that lineup with Lowry, DeRozan, Patterson, Carroll, and Valanciunas was the most used lineup for the Raptors in the series. It was a +8 net rating with 111.3 offensive rating. It's kind of what you expect from that lineup. So I think good on Casey for finally making that move and cutting Louis Scola out of the rotation. I really like, too, how he just, you know, wasn't afraid to experiment with shit, right? That's exactly what we saw in that fourth quarter of game 5. It was like, all right, these are two lineups I haven't used all year. Let's see if it works. And then it worked. And, you know, if you go through the lineup page, there aren't many lineups here with more than like 5 or 6 minutes played together. And that's just because, you know, it seemed like Casey was very much okay with just being like, hey, let's try this for a few minutes, see if it works, and see if we can make it stick. And I thought he did a really nice job in this series. He eventually did start to get DeRozan, you know, some nicer looks, I suppose. DeRozan, I think a lot of what happened in yesterday's game was of his own volition, where he was feeling himself a little bit and decided to take things over. I'm not sure Casey was really calling for those, you know, those contested shots he was taking, you know, those 9 straight shots that he missed at one point. I thought Casey did a nice job, you know, incorporating Valanciunas a little bit more. The pick and roll game with him is quickly becoming a pretty dangerous weapon for the Raptors. All told, I think Casey did a really nice job. He gets a lot of crap, but that would be my he really grew on me as a playoff coach in this series. So let's go quickly through this. One negative from you, Russell, about this series.
I mean, the clear and obvious answer is the shooting of DeMar and Kyle, right? Like,
yeah,
that's been the talk of the series, and it's undeniable that even like every preview I've read today of the series as well is like, well, you know, at least DeMar won't be guarded by someone that's as good, but you know, Kyle's shooting is pretty worrisome, and that's not just going to come back overnight. Like, this is something that, you know, it's not going to be surprising if come the off season, if he all of a sudden has to have an elbow surgery, right? Because the thing is he won't admit it, and you're saying it's not affecting him, and you have to respect his decision to do that. But at the same time, it's like, it's okay to admit that your things aren't going well because of that. So all this is to say is, like, I don't want to make that my negative point, because I think it's too obvious. I think we all know that. I think the negative point that I'm worried a little bit about is that it's a positive that we're shortening the rotation, but if I'm kind of worried now that if someone gets hurt, or if, like, I don't know if it's going to stay that short, because at the end of the day, a player like Terrence Ross is going to have to play more might have to play more minutes over the length of the series, right? Like, game seven is one thing. So I think just now that I've seen what it can be like when it's shortened, I think that I'm a little worried that it'll have to expand out again. And this is my way of saying that I can't really think of a negative and maybe I'll jump back in. Obviously there were a lot of negatives, but I think playing with a lead is one thing that has always bothered me about this Raptors team in general. And it really, we saw it completely in game seven, and they've just got to get, there have to be ideas that they have on how to run at the clock rather than just dribbling the ball like from 30 feet out and then trying to do something. So I think that kind of late game play calls is I'll go with that instead.
John, Russell had three negatives. Give me one.
my negative would be the play of Terrence Ross. I think he should be a rotation player at this point in his career, and the fact that he's bordering on unusable against a seven-seeded Pacers team. It's not even matchup correlated, right? It's just his play is so bad. Is a huge disappointment for this team. They're very lucky that they have a guy like Norman Powell who is prepared to play minutes in a game seven and play them effectively. Because if not, where are they? Like, it's just abysmal where Terrence Ross is at. So that would be a big negative for me. We keep waiting for this guy to come out in the playoffs, and I'm not sure if a series against the Miami Heat is necessarily the time for him to figure things out. So going forward, I think that's my big negative, you know, outside of Lowry's elbow, like Russell mentioned.
Right. Mine is, you touched on it, John. Valanciunas kind of let me down with his screening the last couple games. I think that's just like sort of one missing piece. You know, he's clearly the worst screener among the Raptors centers behind Biombo, right? Biombo's such a good screener. And if Biombo could just catch a damn ball consistently, he'd be a lot more dangerous. But, you know, Valanciunas, he's come a long way, and there are things he's adding. I mean, he's kicking out now and, like, doing so pretty reasonably well, which is nice. He's made so many strides. But just, like, it's not even slipping early. It's just that he's just, like, not getting to a spot or making, like, solid contact with guys, right?
Yeah.
So that was disappointing for me the last couple games. Quickly, we'll just go around the table with, like, I don't know, maybe five words on your series MVP for the Raptors. Russell, go.
Corey Joseph. He was consistent. He was across the board, like, throughout the seven games. He was consistently a good player. He made such smart decisions on offense. He was a great spark off the bench. He was part of all the good lineups. He was the one player, game in, game out, you knew you were getting something good from him. Like, you weren't questioning, like, is this going to be a good DeMar game? Is Kyle going to find his shot? Can DeMar Carroll play X number of minutes? You know, who's Patrick Patterson going to fit with this new group? Is are they going to get Jonas going early? Is he going to be able to take some pressure off the other guys? And even it, like with even with someone like Powell and Ross and those guys, like is Casey going to play them? Like how much time are we going to get out of them? But Corey Joseph, you knew you were going to get his 22 to 25 minutes. You knew he was going to have a big impact when he was on the floor. And I mean, at the end of the day, the dude shot 59% from the field, 56% from three, and 84% from the line. He injected like the Spurs DNA into the Raptors when he was on the floor, and that is so valuable. And yeah, it was him through and through.
John, five words.
Right. Oh yeah.
He keeps stealing my answers. For the sake of being different, I guess I should say Patrick Patterson, because he was able to step up and be a starter and play really well throughout the series. But yeah, my answer is Corey Joseph.
Yeah, Patterson was 41 or 42% from three, which is awesome to see. He did kind of struggle with Solomon Hill, a.k.a. Jason Richardson. but that was okay.
Dude is about to get paid.
Yeah, my pick is DeLon Wright. No, give me Joseph as well. He was just so consistent. If the series had ended a couple games early, it'd be JV, no question. But he sort of struggled down the stretch of the series. So
the Pacers did really well at adjusting on him. Hey,
what's that?
I think the Pacers just did really well on adjusting on him.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Mahimi got healthy too. I think his back stopped bothering him.
Yeah. All right, guys. We went a long time on Game 7. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about the Raptors and the Heat and what to expect in the second round. We'll be back in just a second here. Okay, welcome back to the headquarters. Sean Woodley here with Russell Peddle and John Godis. We're going to dive headfirst into your second round series, Raptors and Heat. The Heat obviously just dispatched the Hornets in a 7-game series. They blew out the Hornets in games 1 and 2. They lost games 3 and 4 in Charlotte, lost game 5, close game in game 6, and then blew out the Hornets pretty terribly in game 7. Been sort of an up and down playoff so far for them. They've been shooting white hot, like their shirts, or been kind of old. Yeah. So I guess let's just like kind of go around and some general matchup stuff and just sort of general impressions on what the Heat are gonna bring. Russell, like, what do you? Let's start, I guess, with John. You mentioned this earlier that the most interesting. You wrote a post about this actually breaking down the series. You mentioned that the most interesting matchup might actually be Jonas Valanciunas against Hassan Whiteside. Russell, let's start with you. What are you expecting from that matchup?
You keep starting with me, and then John has to say, like, well, Russell's the almighty.
Go ahead, John.
Yeah, I think this is, like I said in the post earlier today, I think this is the most intriguing part of this series, outside of Miami's outside shooting, just because it'll be a litmus test, or a barometer, rather, on where this series is going to go. In the most recent game, I think JV won that matchup. And we got a commenter in here who actually made a good point that Hassan Whiteside is a little more foul prone against the Raptors because he is such an aggressive helper. This is an interesting matchup, like on both sides. Like if you consider Miami's offense, Whiteside has increasingly become a bigger part of that down the stretch. As a role player, you can't really switch when he rolls to the basket because he gets to the hoop and he catches literally everything and puts it into the basket. It's huge pressure on Valanciunas to be a good pick and roll defender in this series. And then offensive rebounding, they need to put a body on him. They need to get him outside of the circle because his arms will go literally over and outside of Valanciunas to get the ball. He's a specimen, and that's going to be huge for them to either get him in foul trouble, get him off the floor, or just try to handle him somehow in the pick and roll. And then on the other end, I think Jonas has to go to work on him as well. Al Jefferson did that at points in the series, but he didn't really have the conditioning to do it over a 7-game series. Jonas needs to go at him in the post. They need to give Jonas post touches And if not, they need to drive. They need to pull Whiteside so that Jonas can get putbacks. This could be a huge series for JV if he's engaged and can catch the ball, which is always a question mark, it seems like, with Valanciunas. But, yeah, this it's an exciting matchup between those two guys because they're so different and yet so much the same as kind of the center in a four-out style basketball. So I'm excited to see where that one goes.
Yeah, I think you mentioned the foul-prone aspect of Whiteside. And, I mean, that can really play into the Raptors' hands, of course.
Because the backup is Stoudemire, right?
Yeah, and, you know, I was watching the game on March 12th for the Raptors, and, you know, there's just no way the Heat can play Amar'e Stoudemire against JV. JV destroyed Stoudemire in that game. So that's something to keep an eye out for. Blake Murphy, we were going back and forth today on Twitter, he mentioned that Haslam is probably their go-to backup center right now, which I think you'll live with if you're the Raptors. And so, yeah, the thing with Whiteside is you mentioned the overhelping that he does on drivers because, you know, he kind of searches for blocks a little bit. And, you know, that can work in the Raptors' advantage two ways. First off, like you mentioned, it opens him up for some JV putbacks. It opens up for some dump-offs for Lowry and DeRozan when they get to the rim. They don't need to force things up. Maybe just, you know, sneak a pass into JV instead. And then there's also the fouls thing, right? I mean, the Raptors, you know, they got to the line fine in this series. You know, DeRozan had his games. He didn't have his games. But, you know, if Whiteside is going to be fouling guys, that's very, very crucial because he's very important to what he want to do. And he is maybe the biggest barrier to what the Raptors want to do in terms of getting to the rim. The other thing, too, with the post touches, I agree totally. You know, Al Jefferson sort of bullied Whiteside over the course of that series. Valanciunas is the exact kind of guy like Jefferson that Whiteside can kind of struggle with. And I think, you know, he's not Jan Mahimi in terms of his post defense. Mahimi was almost as good as Gortat was last year in the playoffs, stopping Valanciunas when he tried to get those post ups. Most of Valanciunas' points came on those putbacks or in the pick and roll. So I think, you know, it's a very interesting matchup. Whiteside's weaknesses sort of play into the Raptors' hands, though, I think. What do you think, Russell?
I think you guys pretty much nailed that analysis. I've got nothing more to add.
All right, that'll work.
No, seriously, it's good.
So looking, you know, around the court, like Lowry, obviously, is very important in this series. Maybe without George Hill sort of, like, hugging him on his hip the entire time, he can get some more uncontested looks off. I'm not sure the shot's coming back, but we'll see. Let's just sort of get into the Lowry versus Dragic matchup. With Dragic, it's interesting because, you know, he really excels when he's pushing the pace. And the other thing with Whiteside that I didn't mention is that, you know, he's not going to be giving up those, you know, five tip-ins back to Valanciunas in this game. He's too, in this series, he's too good of a boxer outer, I guess. Too good at boxing out. yeah. And, you know, I'm not sure crashing the glass really plays to the Raptors' advantage. The offensive glass plays to the Raptors' advantage in this series anyway. I think it's probably better to get back and force Miami to do some half-court stuff and keep Dragic from pushing the pace. Russell, what do you see from the Dragic-Lowry matchup?
Well, like you said, I think Lowry's going to have a little bit more room to operate because Dragic isn't as intense of a defender as George Hill is. Honestly, he's had such an up and down season that, you know, he played very well in game seven. But I mean, in the series as a whole, he shot 42%, four assists a game, fine. But I mean, there were times when he kind of disappeared, and I don't think it'll be a constant threat. And I think that, like I said, Lowry will have a bit more room to operate and create. Yes, even if his shot's not falling, he'll have more room to get into plays and to find others. And I think that he's going to be much, he's going to have much more of an opportunity to facilitate and to get his teammates going than in the previous series. So it's almost like a tantalizing matchup compared to what it's coming from because, you know, George Hill is just a fantastic defender for his underrated even for his position because we were focusing so much on Paul George that we, you know, for all of Lowry's struggles, you have to, as much as a lot of it is the elbow, you have to give a lot of credit to the fact that he, you know, he was pushed to the sideline a lot and wasn't able to go down the middle and find his usual spots. So I think that's going to help a lot.
Yeah, maybe it's a little easier for Lowry to get into the paint a little bit, and then that pulls out Whiteside, and that opens things up for JV, and it's just sort of a chain reaction from the point of attack where, you know, Dragic just isn't what George Hill is as an on-ball defender. Anything to add there, John?
No, I think the only thing I can add to that is that, you know, much like Monte Ellis in the last series, Dragic is going to have his game accelerated by transition opportunities. And that's really where Charlotte, you know, dropped the ball in Game 7. They let the crowd get into it in Miami, and they let Dragic get out in the open court and do spectacular things. The Raptors, much like they had to against Indiana, need to stop the live ball turnovers. They can't let this Miami team get out and run, because that gets them, you know, excited. It gets their guys who aren't really good shooters involved in the game. The Raptors need to play this series at their pace, and hopefully they've got all the live ball turnovers out of their system, because that'll accelerate guys like Dragic for sure.
Yeah, maybe with a little less nerves, maybe that helps that.
You'd hope so.
Yeah. I guess let's talk about DeRozan as well. DeRozan doesn't have a ridiculous custom-built defender stopping him in this series. Who do you think will guard him? Do you think it's Justice Winslow? Do you think it's Deng? Do you think it's Joe Johnson? Like, who do you think is going to, you know, draw the assignment most of the time? Do you think it's just a variation of looks like the Raptors did with Paul George?
I personally think that Wade will do it in the starting lineup, and you'll see Winslow get a big bump in minutes as far as guarding him coming off the bench.
Right.
I don't see anybody bigger than Winslow guarding him. Like a Deng, I don't see Deng, because Deng's going to be outside playing a stretch four, a stretch three, and I don't think Joe Johnson will play on him either. So I think it'll be those two guys for the majority of the minutes. Maybe Gerald Green gets a short look, depending on where Richardson's at with his shoulder. But I would say those two guys.
Well, I mean, Gerald Green didn't really play all that much in the first round. Like that's the thing. Again, another thing.
No, he only did because Richardson was hurt in Game 7.
Yeah. The other thing I was talking to Blake about is that, you know, as much as the Raptors shortened their rotation, the Heat were pretty much seven guys in the first round, plus like random Josh McRoberts spurts and, you know, throw in Gerald Green for a minute or two here and there. So, yeah, it's, you know, the Raptors are going to have the depth advantage, I think, again, in this series. Maybe 1-7, the Heat, you know, maybe they're more formidable. But at the same time, they got two rookies in there. And, you know, the thing with DeRozan this season is, you know, Paul George is 6'9". He's bigger. He's got the physical advantage on DeRozan. Other guys that have tried to guard DeRozan this season who are smaller haven't had any luck. He's been able to punish them with post moves. He's been able to blow by them. They've been able to shoot over them. So I don't think we're going to see DeRozan have the same struggles and the complete lack of confidence that he seemed to have for times in this series.
Yeah. One big thing is that we move on, with DeRozan, some of his best splits this season were against Miami. Now, the big thing about the Miami, the Miami-Toronto season series is that you can't really get a read. It's hard to get a read for how these teams will face against each other, because we didn't really see it, because there were people missing. Right? Valanciunas was missing certain games. Carroll was missing certain games. Wade was missing. You know, there was no real game where either of the starting lineups that are projected for this series played against the other team. So
yeah, the most recent game, March 12th, the one I mentioned earlier, the starters for Miami were Joe Johnson, Justice Winslow, Goran Dragic, Deng, and Stoudemire, who kind of fell out of the rotation in the first round. And then the Raptors started Scola and James Johnson alongside Lowry, DeRozan, and Valanciunas.
And there you go. And DeRozan scored in four games, scored 29 points on nearly 49% shooting from the field and 36% from long range. So, you know, it's one of his better matchups as far as the regular season series goes. Now, we know how much that really matters at the once the series actually starts. But at the end of the day, we've seen that some of his best performances come against the Heat. So they're almost certainly going to shut him down, because he's proven that he can work, he can operate against this team very well. So
Yeah, and we saw DeRozan against the Pacers in the regular season have a couple of pretty tough games. So
exactly.
Yeah, you mentioned that final game, DeRozan was 13 of 26 for 38 points, 10 of 10, for, or sorry, 12 of 15 from the line with 10 boards and 7 assists. It was one of his best games of the year.
There you go.
He was a killer in that game. And, you know, Whiteside had 5 fouls in 33 minutes. Josh Richardson had 5 fouls. You know, Stoudemire had 4 fouls. You know, they racked up the fouls in that game, which was what really helped the Raptors. And maybe that's something they can carry over. We seem to be pretty positive right now through what we've talked about through the different matchup things. Let's talk about where the Raptors could really get burned in this series. Russell, where do you think the Raptors are vulnerable?
I think one thing, not necessarily that they're vulnerable, but one thing that they're really going to have to keep in check is the points in the paint. This is something where it's the classic one team is really good at it and the other team is really good at defending it. Type thing, and really which way that goes is going to make a big difference in the regular season. Like Miami was a top five team. I don't have the exact numbers in front of me in terms of points in the paint per game, and the Raptors were like top five in opponents' points per in the paint per game. So I think that'll dictate a lot, because in the Pacers series it made a big deal too, because like when the Raptors had that advantage, had that advantage in the games that they won and gave it up in the games that they lost. Now, I know that's a bit of a pretty simplistic analysis, but it that differential was one of those things with turnovers that really made a difference in the last series and will make an even bigger difference in this series. And I think on top of that is, at the end of the day, the Heat are a bad shooting team. And
They sort of turned that around in the second half.
Yeah, I don't think that's really correct at this point, because they're shooting phenomenally well in the playoffs, and it was sustainable over a 7-game series. So I don't think you could say they're a poor shooting team.
Okay, not that they're a poor shooting team, but they don't have the same knockdown shooting threats that you're terrified of that are going to be on the floor like long periods of time, like a Paul.
Yeah, I don't think they. I think they're just limited in the number of guys that do shoot their threes, but the guys that do shoot them are like on fire.
Yeah, no, and that's fair, but I mean, at the end of the day, I don't think Luol Deng is going to shoot over 50% from three for much longer, and I don't think, you know, I'm not as concerned about that. And my point being that if they can keep them off the, like, cause one problem in that Pacers series is there were times where they weren't getting to their rotations fast enough, and they were running out of guys on the line way too late, and giving up. And my point is, they can't give up that type of stuff to the Heat, because the Heat are going to, a lot of their points come from in the paint. So if I had numbers for this, sorry, and I'm having trouble finding them now. But
okay.
But I mean, my point being that the Heat on the season, now I know that it shifted. Like, it's not the same team throughout the season, because we're also talking about a team that doesn't have Bosch right now, right?
Yeah.
But for instance, they got 46.4% of their points in the paint, and only 18.2 from the 3-point line. So it's one of those things where it's found money for them if they start hitting open threes as well. So it's going to be very important to defend the 3-point line. I know that's, at the end of the day, I just said defend the 3-point line and defend the paint. Obviously, like, there couldn't be anything more obvious, but. Like,
building on that point, I think that something's got to give with the Heat in this series, otherwise the Raptors are in trouble, right? The Heat are going to be successful if they've got Whiteside in the game, if they've got Wade driving and being a paint threat, and they've got that three-point shot going with guys like Deng and Joe Johnson. Like, if all three of those things are happening, the Raptors are in real trouble. So you kind of have to take away something. You have to either get Whiteside in foul trouble. You have to protect the paint and be solid on Wade and Dragic's drives, or you need to defend the three-point line better. I don't know if the latter one is gonna happen for the Raptors. I think you just have to hope that the Heat will normalize in that regard, but they've got to take away one of those three things, otherwise it's going to be a short series.
Yeah, and the other thing too is I think the pick-and-roll defense from Valanciunas on Whiteside has to be pretty great, because, you know, if Whiteside is allowed to just scream to the rim uncontested, that's going to bode pretty poorly for the Raptors. As you mentioned, the points in the paint, like, that's a big part of where that comes from. and with Whiteside too is, you know, Biombo actually did a pretty nice job. I'm working my way through the March 12th game right now. Biombo had a couple plays where he sort of poked away lob passes to Whiteside, and he, you know, he has the verticality and sort of the hops to do that. Valanciunas doesn't really have those instincts, I don't think, at this point. And so you can improve your defense on Whiteside by putting Biombo in the game, but at the same time, that sort of limits the advantage you could sort of exploit with Whiteside being really aggressive towards drivers and leaving the big man open. So Valanciunas is going to be really key in this series. His defense is, I think his offense will be there. I think he's going to be able to sort of do what he wants against Whiteside at the post, but at the same time, in the pick and roll, Whiteside might be able to defend that pretty well. And I think on the other side, Valanciunas needs to shut down those runs to the basket, because that could get ugly pretty quickly if Whiteside is just catching lob after lob after lob from Goran Dragic. Dwayne Wade. We're expecting like a 36-point Dwayne Wade game or two in this series, right, that just crushes the soul of the Raptors. John, let's start with you. We'll go back around. Who guards Dwayne Wade in this series? What do you expect from Dwayne Wade? He's obviously not, you know, 30-point a game Dwayne Wade from whatever season that was, 08 or 09. But, you know, he's still Dwayne freaking Wade. He's kind of terrifying, and he's played pretty well in these playoffs. So how do you think the Raptors need to attack him?
Yeah, Wade is frightening for a lot of different reasons, because he is still the focal point of that team. He creates, when he drives to the basket, he creates either for himself or for his teammates. He usually makes the right decision in those in that regards. He's still a terrifying transition player on offense and defense. As far as the assignment goes, it depends on where Dwayne Casey, you know, is most worried about being burnt. Like I mentioned earlier, those three facets. If he's worried about Joe Johnson's shooting more than he's worried about Wade's drives, I think Carroll opens on Johnson and not Wade, and DeRozan gets a look. But if he's more worried about Wade, I think Carroll and Powell will kind of get that assignment in tandem. But that shifted, obviously, in the first round series. They started with DeRozan on George and then made the adjustments, the necessary adjustments. So I wouldn't be surprised if you see DeRozan open on him in game one. But they're going to have to pick and choose, like I said, what they want to focus on. And it might come to Carroll and Powell at some point.
Yeah, I mean, if Powell is a guy who was able to shut down 6'9" monstrous Paul George, or at least play reasonable defense on him, maybe he's able to do something, you know, similar. I don't know.
Wade's a bit craftier, I think, than Paul
would
have been. He's a challenge because he's playing like his vintage self, and that's an impossible player to guard. And it'll be really interesting. I'm really excited to see how that plays out through the series.
Russell, anything to add on Wade?
No, not really. I think John nailed it. I think that DeRozan will start on him and be given his shot to go mano a mano there. But I think at the end of the day, like, you're gonna have to, we're probably gonna have to see some like one big three wing lineups type thing to kind of make sure that that Powell and Carroll can be out there at times to guard both Wade and Johnson.
All right, we kind of just sort of whipped around this series and the matchups pretty quickly there, but I think some of your other questions will be hit on in the questions that we have, and also we're going to get to those right now, and also read John's post sort of previewing the series. It's very good. So yeah, I'm just going to pull up our questions right now. We have five or six, so we'll get to those right now. First one, Sasha Kalra. How short is Ross's leash with Norm waiting to eat all of his minutes? I'll take this one first. I think it's obviously pretty short. He played 5 minutes in Game 7. I'm not sure if KC is really, you know, committed to him playing a ton of minutes. It would be nice if Ross could play well, because that opens up a lot more flexibility in terms of the small lineups the Raptors can use, but I don't think Casey's going to risk it if he's not playing well. Russell, what do you think?
I think Ross is a bonus at this point. If he comes in and he like, you know, the whole point of him coming in is to hit some three pointers. So if he comes in and hits a couple shots, and, you know, then he's served his role. Like, I don't think that there's any reason to force that issue. So I don't know if he'll fall out entirely. I'm sure he'll get plenty of games where he'll be inserted in, and just to see how he's feeling and how the shot's flowing. And if it's not, I think that the leash will be pretty short.
John, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree with Russell completely. I think it's also his defense too. It was both were a problem, I think, in the Pacers series down the stretch. He was floating on defense as he tends to do, and he was missing his 3-point shot. And if both those things happen, he's basically unplayable. He's not a rotation player if both those things are happening. So he's either got to be, you know, solid on defense, and I'm not sure where kind of that test subject is on the Miami Heat roster for him to show off defensively. Other than
he's the Joe Johnson defender.
Oh man, remember those days?
Yeah.
I could see maybe Josh Richardson being a good opportunity for him to work his way back into the rotation, similar to how McBob might be a way to get Scola back in. But
Here's something interesting. I didn't know. Like regular season series again, you can toss it out the window now. But Ross shot 54% from the field and 53% from 3-point range in four games against them this season.
He's the Luol Deng of the Raptors.
Apparently.
Well, that would be great. I don't really have anything more to add on Ross.
If he gets in, yeah, and hits a couple threes per game, then that's just a bonus at this point. Because I think it's safe to say, like, Powell has taken his spot in the rotation.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Next question comes from Will Liu. Can the Raptors afford to go small with Carroll at the four? That's interesting because you would think maybe the default lineup with Luol Deng being the four would be to sort of quickly go small, put Carroll at four. But at the same time, you know, you have to do a lot of cross matching there in order to put him on the guys you really want to stop in Wade and Joe Johnson. So, you know, if the Heat are able to, you know, get out in transition the way they like to and Dragic is pushing the pace, that could lead to some spotty transition defense in terms of trying to, you know, match up with the guy you're supposed to be with. And we've seen how the Raptors do that, with transition defense when it's not that difficult. So Russell, what do you think there?
Yeah, I think you nailed it. The cross matches become difficult because if you're going to go small and put Carroll at the four and he and Powell are both in there to check Johnson and Wade, then what are you doing? Are you throwing like Lowry on Deng? Like,
DeRozan, I guess.
DeRozan, yeah. But I mean, I think they could certainly afford to do it. I think they'll be forced to do it at times, depending on the lineups. But you know, that's something that we've seen can be successful, and I'm interested to see it. I think this is a really good series to have now, where you just came off discovering in the Pacers series that some small lineups, like the one that basically won Game 5, can work, and you're going to need those against this Miami Heat team that plays, especially like since Bosch went out, when Deng essentially became a stretch four, that you're going to not only can you afford to play some lineups, but there are going to be times where it's going to be completely necessary.
John, what do you think?
Yeah, I will definitely see it. I'm curious to see how it turns out for all the reasons you guys said. But yeah, big minutes for Patrick Patterson in this series because he's really the only playable four, and the cross matches are crazy when you play Carroll at the four. So yeah, definitely curious to see how it plays out.
All right, next question comes from Joe Anderson at J16Anderson on Twitter. We've already kind of touched on this. He said, Norm, do we see increased minutes for him?
Hell yeah.
Yeah, what's the matchup like for the series? I think he's going to guard a bunch of different dudes. I think he's going to get time on Wade. I think he's going to get time on Johnson. Probably get time on like the secondary guys as well when they're in there. And yeah, I think he gets a ton of minutes. We can move on from that. Thanks for the question. Next one is David Mann at David Mann CDN. What's up with Lowry? Is he injured or lacking confidence? I think we can safely say now that he's injured.
Well, Zach Lowe says that he hears that there is no injury.
Really?
That he said that on the podcast today. And he's the man.
It's true, he is.
That's tough to like disagree with.
Now I'm all sorts of intrigued. I've been intrigued for the last 6 hours now. I've been like...
Maybe it was just George Hill. Maybe it's just George Hill. Yeah. Maybe
I've been like Illuminati stuff with this Kyle Lowry injury. So we'll get
into Bruce Arthur... Bruce Arthur did mention that he saw this golf ball sized thing on his arm, so I'm not sure. I guess no one really knows.
Border fight.
Yeah. So we'll see. Hopefully Zach Lowe is correct there. I like to believe Zach Lowe what he says. So, all right, next one comes from David Mann as well. Predictions for Ross minutes versus the Heat. Should be taken out of the rotation. I think he'll probably play, you know, I think it'll be sort of similar to what it was last series where, you know, if he's not playing well, he's not going to be in the rotation. If Powell's playing really well, you know, Ross's minutes are going to get cut. I would guess, I don't know, 10 minutes a game for Ross. Russell?
Yeah, I think that's about safe. By the end of the series, there were about 30 minutes spent between Powell and Ross, and I think maybe now we see Powell getting in the 20 to 22 range and Ross more the 8th to 10.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that. You know, with this team struggling so much on offense in that Pacers series, it does come down to which guy is making shots, but because Powell brings all the intangibles, I think he's just much more useful at this point. But if he has an off night and Ross makes a couple shots, I could see that swinging the other way too.
Okay. Next from Mitch Robson. Who plays first, Udonis or James Johnson? I think we sort of touched on this. I think Udonis, because you can't play Amari Stoudemire against Valanciunas. You know, Haslam won't be much better. He's a better defender at least, though. But yeah, it's like, James Johnson isn't touching the floor of this series. Like, please, if he does, there's a real problem. What do you think, Russell?
I think that it'll be Haslam for the reasons that you mentioned. Although I'm not completely convinced that Johnson won't see the floor. I think that if, you know, there adjustments will need to be made. Like, we can't look at what we saw coming out of that Pacer series and think that everything's set in stone. Like, if the Heat come out and win game one, let's say, their adjustments are going to have to be made. And the fact that the Heat are so successful with a kind of a sort of a three-wing lineup, I wouldn't be surprised if at some point, like, if you're playing DeRozan, Powell and Carroll minutes, for instance, to counter that, you know, at that point, James Johnson and Terrence Ross, and if Ross isn't going and you're more concerned with defense, you might be forced to play James Johnson a bit. But I mean, I at the end of the day, neither of them is going to make much of an impact on this series. Like, that's safe to say. So I guess if I were a betting man, I would say that Haslam will see the time first for the reasons that you mentioned, especially like if Whiteside gets in foul trouble.
Yeah. John?
Yeah, I want to see at least one 14-foot Haslam jump shot from the baseline this series.
All right, just before we get to our final segment, we're going to do the obligatory predictions. Russell, what are you thinking for this series?
I'm torn, and I was asked this today, and I honestly, the person that's followed the Raptors all year and that honestly doesn't believe that, like, I don't think this Heat team is a juggernaut by any stretch of the imagination, and they had an up and down season. As much as they're peaking at the right time now, there wasn't, like, I don't really see them as a team that's obviously going to beat Toronto, and some people, I think, saw the weird, like, Toronto-Indiana series and are kind of thinking that Toronto could be destroyed by Miami, and I don't think that's necessarily the case. So I could honestly, I feel like Raptors in seven is something that I believe could happen, but I think the most likely scenario is Miami in six.
All right, John, what do you think?
Yeah, I said in the preview post, Raptors in seven. I think I'm going to stick with that. I believe they have the matchups at different places on the floor to win this series. It's just about execution, and hopefully, Lowry's shot shows up at some point in this series.
Yeah, that would be nice. I will stick to being the most optimistic person, maybe other than Russell, with our site. I'm going to go Raptors in six. I think the Raptors really have ways to exploit what Miami's weaknesses are, especially when it comes to, you know, how you can take advantage of Whiteside. Whiteside is a monster, but I think you can definitely exploit him if he's, you know, going to his tendencies, especially with the guys the Raptors have, with the really good driving passers that Lowry and DeRozan are, and, you know, Valanciunas is a guy to catch dump offs, put back tip-ins and things like that. Maybe I'm, you know, reducing it down too much, but I think the Raptors, you know, they played pretty poorly against Indiana, and Indiana was a weird matchup with two defenders who really, you know, shut down the two best players on the Raptors. I don't think they're going to see that this year. I think DeRozan's actually going to have a monster series. I'm not sure about Lowry, but I think DeRozan is really going to continue over what he did during the regular season against the Heat, unless Eric Spoelstra comes up with some, you know, plot to stop him. Raptors in six, probably going to be wrong, but let's roll with it. Maybe I'm riding too high on the emotion of last night. But that's what we'll go with. All right. We are going to take a quick break. We'll be back on the other side with a very quick episode sponsor. All right, welcome back to the headquarters. Sean Woodley here with Russell Peddle and John Godis. Gonna dive into our episode sponsor this week. This week's episode is brought to you by Del Curry, the father of the best player in the NBA, who has a messed up knee, and it's very sad. But there's a reasoning behind why I chose Del Curry for this. I've chosen a game. We're gonna play the game. Get ready, boys. We're gonna play that random Raptors game.
I hate this.
The first game of the second round series against the Philadelphia 76ers in 2001, Del Curry had 20 points on 7 of 12 shooting, 4 from 9 from 3, 4 rebounds, played 34 minutes, was the second leading scorer on the team behind Vince Carter off the bench. Very, very, you know, solid performance from Del Curry. I don't really remember anything from Del Curry as a player with the Raptors. I think I was still too young. I mostly just remember Vince and Antonio Davis and Charles Oakley, but... do you have any Del Curry memories?
Well, I just, because I remember him from before he was with the Raptors with Charlotte, and, you know, as part of those Charlotte teams that were just, you know, everyone was wearing the Hornets starters jackets, and he was part of the team that those teams, and he was on the NBA Jam team and stuff like that. So I definitely remember being excited that he was a Raptor and just having like a knockdown shooter like that on the team was so huge. So yeah, I most certainly remember. I'm thinking of him as like every team feels like they need that just really excellent shooter, and it reminds me of. Players like I'm using a Raptor comparison, but maybe not a good one, but like Jason Capono,
right?
And so I always like when my team has that, and it's funny because I liken it to video games again. Like I always took the Raptors and tried to play through regular seasons and playoffs with the Raptors, and I always liked having a guy that I could rely on for three pointers when the team was down. So I remember really appreciating Del Curry for that reason.
Fair enough. Anything for you, John?
I'm just going to say I thought you picked him because he inbounded the ball to Vince Carter in the Game 7 missed shot. I thought that's why you picked him, because we've been seeing that clip like on repeat every hour for the last 3 days. They even showed it after they won the game. Like, oh, they did it, but look at all the times they didn't do it. Mel Curry inbounding the ball. Remember this? I thought that's why
you picked him. From what I picked up, it sounded like the broadcast was very much like harping on the fact that the Raptors couldn't do it in the playoffs
before. Oh, they showed the Vince Carter shot 3 times. They showed it at the beginning of the pregame show. They showed it in the montage before tip. And they showed it late in the fourth quarter during, like, the complete meltdown. They were like, you've seen it before. Here's Vince Carter missing the shot again.
I guess Del Curry was sort of the veteran presence that Luis Scola is for this team. He was 35, 36, and 37 for his 3 seasons with the Raptors from 99 through 2002. He averaged 6.7 points. He shot 39% from three, which for that era is not bad at all. I guess we see where the child he had, you know, learned it from.
Seth Curry is so good.
He's awesome. Okay, you're going to play that random Raptors game.
I want to go first because I am so bad at this game, and I feel like I'll actually get some for this one.
Well, so here's the thing.
You picked the 2001 playoffs. So you could clean this up in like 10 seconds flat.
Well, so here's the thing.
Don't go to Russell.
The last time we played this game was with Mitch Robson and Kevin Young, and I came up with a better way to play it. So we go one for one, and then you get points if you get a guy right. And you just go back and forth until... there's no one left. Whoever has got the most correct wins the game.
Oh, that's a cool way to do it.
Much better.
So, Del Curry is one. There are 9 guys remaining. John, we'll start with you.
Carter.
Yes.
Antonio Davis.
Correct.
Charles Oakley.
Yep.
Alvin Williams.
Yep.
Morris Peterson.
Yes, Morris Peterson played 1 minute in this game.
Morris Peterson only played 1 minute in that game?
Wow.
I don't remember it that
Zeros
way.
Zeros across the board.
This was the first game of the series?
Yes.
How do I not remember that?
Yeah, he played one. I don't know.
He played more down the stretch. I watched a bit of Game 7 just to really wet my palate for disappointment on Sunday. And he played a lot more down the stretch in that series.
Well, that's it. I definitely remember him in that series, but I guess...
Was this his rookie year or is his sophomore year?
It might have been his rookie year.
Okay, so you're missing 1 starter and 3 bench guys. Who just got Morris Peterson? Is that you, John?
Yes.
Yes, it was.
Okay, so is it 3-2 right now?
Yes.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So you got the pick before me. Did we get the whole starting lineup?
No, 1 starter missing.
Chris Childs.
Yes. Oh. He had a glowing stat line of 0 points. 4 rebounds, 4 assists on 0-for-4 shooting in 22 minutes. The next guy is John. Go. There's 3 guys left.
Jerome Williams, the Junkyard Dog.
Yes. 4-3. Your turn, Russell.
Let me think. Philadelphia.
I'm like tapped out. Like, I don't know anymore, so... I thought Russell would.
There's 2. So, okay, so that's my chance to steal this then. Yeah. Keon Clark.
Correct. He played 12 minutes, had 3 points, 47 blocks, 3 rebounds.
Oh, man.
1 guy left. John?
One guy. There was somebody who played in this game who wasn't one of those guys.
He played 5 minutes, had 6 rebounds.
Was this a blowout?
He was a 7-footer. He played from...
Oh, 94. I got it.
Yeah, I don't know it. Give it to him.
Eric Montross.
Eric Montross, you are correct.
Wow, we're good.
That's a deep cut right there.
Yeah.
It's not that deep, though. I mean, like, that playoff series is... Like you said, we just watched... I'm sure with all the clips we saw of that in the last few days, we could have pieced it together.
Fair enough. All right, boys. I really got to take a pee, so we're going to wrap this up.
Fair enough.
I drank a gigantic gallon of lemon water while we were doing this, so it's catching up to me now.
Really is behind the curtain.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining me today, boys, and let's look forward to this series. Anything from you guys coming down to the site? Russell?
No, me and Hackett are kind of alternating stat breakdowns after each game, so I'll be doing game 1 of this series, I guess, because he had game 7 in the last one, so... That's basically my Raptors HQ contributions for the playoffs.
Cool. John, anything from you?
Yeah, well, I did the Heat preview today, so that'll be solid content for another 24 hours before the game starts. And as always, HQ overtime after every Raptors playoff game. Check the site for details.
Yes, you've been doing an awesome job.
Those shows are really fun. You should be commended for that. Good job.
Thanks, guys. I got Dan Grant, so we got some new face for game 1, so it should be good.
Awesome. I will be writing sort of the longer breakdown of game 1, probably sometime on Wednesday afternoon that'll be up. Do something for game 2 as well, probably the quick recap. Had the quick recap from game 7 last night if you want to go relive some stuff. It's a pretty short read, so check that out. And I guess that's it, boys. You can follow the show on follow us on Twitter. I'm at Woodley Sean. Russell's at Rusty Pedal Bike. John is at John Godis. Raptors HQ is obviously at Raptors HQ. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, rate, review, subscribe, all that fun stuff. We really appreciate any and all feedback. And thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode of The Headquarters.